Welcome to the swing era. By now, we have some sense of what happens, but we really understand why. As to the what, we know quite a lot already about the 1930s. We know about the new craze for social dancing. Dancing has become popular at home and in public, and so dance bands are responding to this need. We know also that there are new technologies, phonograph records, and radio. So there are radio broadcasts being made from famous big dance halls, like the Roseland, Savoy, the Aragon, the Palladium, the Trianon. We also know that jazz has gathered an increasingly white audience during the 1930s, and that at some of these dance halls, there are people who were just listening, sitting around the bandstand, not dancing, just listening to the music. We know the bands have gotten bigger. We talked a little bit about the Depression and why having a cheaper labor force might have helped with the bands get bigger, how the architecture changed, that sort of thing. We also know that jazz has become an arranger's art, that Louis Armstrong made jazz a soloist's art, but as the bands got bigger, we needed to have arrangers. We also know that jazz developed a smoother style, that thanks to Louis Armstrong, Fletcher Henderson, and Count Basie, a new style had crystallized where this swing had been successfully transferred to the dance band. It then crossed over to white bands, and again, good musicians assimilated Armstrong and Henderson's style. So instead of having a two beat with the tuba or the string bass on two, a kind of oom-pa, oom-pa, we now have a lighter drum beat and hi-hat, so we've got more of a boom, 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 an even four beat. But none of this explains why historians normally date the swing era from August 21st, 1935. None of this explains why the word jazz had to be changed to swing. None of this explains how jazz became so popular with a wealthy white audience. In fact, how jazz became America's music. If you remember, in the 1920s, even during the jazz age, jazz was a negative term. Jazz was a virus. Jazz was a kind of Africanization of American culture that was infecting America. But by the mid-1930s, that changed. Maybe that's why we needed a name change. But swing was no longer a virus, was no longer a negative. Swing was just good, clean fun. It was America's music. In the Busby Berkeley film Strike Up the Band in 1940, the change is so profound that even Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland can have fun with swing, that all that matters for Mickey Rooney is just to have a band. And so swing becomes a representative of democracy. Think about what an enormous change this was. If you think about America in the 19th century, if you think about baseball and apple pie and mom sitting on the front porch, that vision of America is a largely New England waspy one. Puritan Protestant culture was what was mainstream in America. And Manhattan, New York, was somehow not really America. It was beyond America. It was sometimes called mongrel Manhattan. It was full of immigrants and Jews and blacks. If you can think back to pre-9/11 America, this image of New York had kind of remained. I mean, there were lots of lawyer jokes. Remember those old jokes? What the first thing you do? Kill all the lawyers. People stopped making those jokes after 9/11, but there was still something in American culture that held New York and all of those immigrants kind of suspect. If you look at the picture on your screen, think about how unlikely this is. A few years before this picture, Benny Goodman, a nerdy middle-aged Jew with glasses, would not even have been allowed in a fancy hotel like this. And all of a sudden, here he is with his glasses as a pop star entertaining America's elite, who have, since the time of George Washington, always been Protestants, always been Christians, always been white. So that When in the 1920s, this new culture arose, these African dances, it was all suspect. It was a virus. So what's interesting about this, and what we have to try to explain, is what happened in the 1930s, so that by the time of the Second World War, America was championing jazz, swing, as its own music, as something uniquely American. It probably helped that both the Nazis and the Japanese banned this music precisely because it was Jewish and black, as degenerate. So America responded by talking about how swing was really democratic, how it allowed for the various people to take their turn, each having a solo, that swing represents individual innovation, but also a pluralist vision of America. Glenn Miller became a captain and created his Melting Pot Band. But of course, not everyone was allowed in this American melting pot. The army, as well as the music industry, was still segregated. If you look at the picture on your screen now, you'll see what the reality was like for black musicians, the same black musicians who had invented this music, who, okay, it had been a virus, they had been second-class citizens, but now somebody else was getting famous, popularizing the same music that they had been playing for the first half of the decade. But it was the son of Jewish immigrants, born in 1909 in Chicago, who became the king of swing. Benny moved to New York in 1928 and started working in pit bands, like in George Gershwin's shows Strike Up the Band and Girl Crazy. He did lots of freelance radio work, hundreds of recordings, and he was almost always the improviser or the hot player, but it was usually an eight-bar solo. Then in 1934, when Fletcher Henderson was disbanding, Benny was trying to form his own band. And John Hammond, the Yale dropout from the Vanderbilt family, who became a producer who also discovered Billie Holiday, John Hammond convinced Benny Goodman to buy Fletcher Henderson's charts, the pieces of paper that made up the arrangements. Now, Goodman was a professional who had the attitude that hot jazz wasn't commercial enough and wouldn't sell. But Benny soon got his big break that would change jazz history. He was hired to do the Let's Dance radio show. The National Biscuit Company had a new product and they wanted a radio show to sell it. This new product was called the Ritz Cracker. You'll remember from last week when we compared the Benny Goodman versions to the original Fletcher Henderson that Benny's band is a little better rehearsed, it's a little bit tighter, it lacks some of the punch, perhaps, but it's a little bit smoother. But basically, he's playing the same music. So, the Let's Dance show was broadcast from New York City, and Benny's band came on last. It was the hot jazz band at the end. So the show was popular. Benny Goodman's band was popular. They decided to book a cross-country tour, but the tour wasn't a success. As they moved their way across country, people who were in the earlier time zones had been going to sleep before the Benny Goodman part of the show came on. So they hadn't heard of Benny Goodman. They'd heard of the earlier bands like Xavier Cugat, who was playing a kind of watered-down version of Latin big band music. So as Benny's band crossed the country, they were booed, people didn't show up, or they were asked to play more traditional music, waltzes, stuff we can dance to. So as Benny crosses the country, he gets more and more depressed. But finally, he gets to the Palomar Ballroom in Los Angeles, where a local DJ has been playing Benny Goodman, and with the time change, it's earlier in the evening, and people are listening to Benny Goodman. So on opening night, August 21st, 1935, the band walks out and plays what it's been playing in Colorado and in Indiana. It plays sweet dance music, waltzes, and they're bombing. So Benny says, "What the heck? If we're going to go out, we should go out swinging." This is Bugle Call Ray, Benny Goodman's orchestra. There's also a video version of this on the Blackboard website that I recommend. This piece is called a killer diller, which means it's very fast, very intricate, If you remember your dance lessons from earlier this week, you know, this is hard. This is going to be a very sweaty dance because it's so fast. The band is tight and it has great energy from Gene Krupa playing the drums, who really likes to play all four beats. Gene Krupa and Benny Goodman together also made up half of the Benny Goodman Quartet. It was very common at this time to have a band within a band, to have a small combo. Benny took a great risk and had one of the first interracial combos. He hired Teddy Wilson to play the piano and Lionel Hampton on vibes. Both of them played in the band and also in the Benny Goodman Quartet. If you'll look in the course notes, you'll notice there's a reading about this and about the predicted race riot in Dallas. Take a look at the readings and we'll talk more about the ramifications of this mixed race quartet in class. Even the most hardcore jazz lover can find a place for Benny Goodman. He could play, the band was hot, lots of great soloists and energy. But Glenn Miller had the sweetest band in the swing era and one of the most controversial, also the most popular. Sometimes called romantic swing, he used a clarinet in the sax section as the lead, and he had lots of hits that you know, Moonlight Serenade, In the Mood, Chattanooga Choo Choo, String of Pearls, Tuxedo Junction, Little Brown Jug, etc. And of course, dying in 1944, somewhat mysteriously, helped the myth, and for millions and millions of America, Glenn Miller is the swing era. And of course, having Jimmy Stewart play you in the movie isn't so bad either. But Glenn Miller had a sound, not a style. But for all its lack of scope, it's distinctive. He was a career arranger, and he started his own band in 1937. He learned from Goodman the importance of 4/4 swing and of rehearsal and getting the band to sound tight. But he wanted to be popular, and so he deliberately avoided experimentation. He knew he had to distinguish his sound from Benny Goodman's, and so he pared things down to a more basic texture. Three qualities that in the elite musical public have a sort of low opinion of this, but the three qualities were a smoothness of rhythm, uncomplicated music, and contrast of textures. But the band was mostly known for its sax sound, its very clear, smooth sax sound with this high clarinet lead that you can hear on hits like Moonlight Serenade. That's the Glenn Miller sound. It's beautiful, and maybe that's the problem that some jazz lovers had with it. Here's another example, String of Pearls. Glenn Miller's own description of his music was smooth music with a little bit of jump in it. What could be more perfect for America at war? Think also about the title. Remember the Bessie Smith tune we listened to, the Need a Little Sugar in My Bowl? Well, that was a jazz song, not a blues, remember. But now we're listening to A String of Pearls. Think about what the title suggests. Think about, in fact, the content of all of Glenn Miller's songs and titles. Think about Tuxedo Junction, Chattanooga Choo Choo, or I've Got a Gal in Kalamazoo. So, how might Miller have been more accessible to middle America than Bessie Smith or even the other black big bands? After a scathing review, Glenn Miller said to John Hammond, "Why do you judge me as a musician? All I'm interested in is in making money." And he made millions on the tune In the Mood. So again, we come back to Why did this music become so popular? When Fletcher Henderson played it or Chick Webb played it, it had not been nearly as popular. Was it simply the same music with a white face? Or is swing music somehow different from jazz? Miller made race an explicit part of his musical ends. He had a vocal group called the Modern Airs. You can see them on a Blackboard web clip. And he said it had to have a Jew, a Catholic, a Protestant, and a Christian Scientist in the group. He talked about the ethnic stereotypes in his band, too. He said, Italian trumpets seldom play good jazz, but they make great lead men. And you can't have a good band without at least one Jew. So Glenn Miller talked loudly about how his group was multi-ethnic. It was, as he said, the face of America. Now, when Glenn Miller was asked to create America's jazz band for the Army Air Force, the armed forces were, of course, all segregated. And all of this multi-ethnic bands, all of this talk, never included any African Americans. The Pentagon insisted that, quote, Negroes lacked the courage, discipline, and intelligence to fight efficiently, end quote. So initially, African Americans could not serve at all. But the NAACP complained and held rallies. And eventually, the manpower shortage got severe enough that special non-combat units of black nurses were formed, although, of course, they were not allowed to work with white servicemen. African Americans would be allowed only to serve in separate units, only as porters, garbage collectors, and cooks. Did you ever wonder who picked up all the dead bodies after D-Day? Black units spent weeks loading bodies on trucks. After the Battle of the Bulge, however, General Eisenhower finally decided to call for 2,000 black soldiers to replace white casualties in combat units. The Tuskegee Airmen were finally allowed to fly. Tuskegee was a segregated air base in Alabama, and the airmen were commanded by Colonel Benjamin O. Davis, Jr. They were assigned to escort bombers, but were ordered not to shoot down more than 4 enemy airplanes, because shooting down 5 German airplanes made you an ace. So in 1930, multicultural America did not mean black America. Meet Harold Montgomery. He was part of that first group of black combat divisions deployed in World War II, the Army's 92nd, the Buffalo Soldiers Infantry Division, white officers with black troops. In the summer of 1944, they were one of the first units to land in Naples. It was pitch black that night. There were so many wrecked boats in the harbor that the only way to get ashore was for the men to walk across narrow planks that were swaying unsteadily under the weight of their packs while German fighters strafed them. Harold Montgomery recalls that as he made it to the dock, he remembers a sound, quote, like the roar of a crowd in a ballpark, he said. Hundreds of black service troops stationed in Italy, those cooks, stewards, and bricklayers, had gathered to cheer the arrival of the first combat soldiers in Italy. For the remainder of the war, black soldiers were kept in segregated units, made to sit behind the German prisoners of war doing USO concerts, and banished from the very streets they had liberated once the white nurses moved in. Immediately, at the end of the war, all black soldiers were stripped of rank and sent back to labor units cleaning toilets used by German POWs. The Buffalo soldiers refused, and the army threatened to court-martial them. 200 black soldiers marched to the stockade and dared the U.S. Army to execute them. The army finally relented and allowed them to return home, but President Truman did not segregate the military for another 3 years. Another of these men was James Strotter. He was also in that initial unit that picked up D-Day bodies for weeks and said, quote, I had already risked death. I didn't give a John. Now, after 4.5 years of serving his country and fighting his way up the western coast of Italy, the 24-year-old Captain Montgomery returned to Washington, D.C. to reclaim his old job where he had worked at the United States Postal Service. Well, he was given his job back, but told that unlike the white soldiers, he would not be receiving the veterans' pay increase. He then walked into the main lobby where you can still walk today in Washington, and he looked at the large plaque that's still there honoring the postal employees who had served in the war. Go to the General Accounting Office in Washington, D.C. It's still there in the lobby. It still does not list Harold Montgomery or any of the black soldiers. How do you think he felt? What do you think he felt about white Americans' fascination with Glenn Miller's multiracial band? Quote, he said, "I was really disgusted with this country. I was angry, and I stayed angry for years," end quote. He also said that the black troops were angry young men. Quote, "We used to say, if we don't kill these Germans, they'll come home and become our bosses," end quote. African Americans were good enough to die for democracy, but they returned home not to a hero's welcome, but being called boy still. This anger changed American society in the 1940s and 50s and led to the Civil Rights Movement. Why shouldn't it also change the music? They returned not to swing, but to bebop, Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie. So this is the next music that we're going to study. But even a quick listen should demonstrate to you how different this music is. It's too fast to dance to. It's aggressive and irregular, maybe even a little hostile to its audience. And it's the next thing on our syllabus. It's called bebop.